Chapter 11. More probable in that, as above, the wharfage of those landing places is still the property of the Corporation of Truro. But let this be as it will, the trade is now in a manner wholly gone to Falmouth, the trade at Truro, being now chiefly if, not only, for the shipping off of block tin and copper ore, the latter being lately found in large quantities in some of the mountains between Truro and St. Michael's, and which is much improved since the several mills are erected at Bristol, and other parts for the manufactures of battery ware, as it is called brass, or which is made out of English copper, most of it ducked in these parts the ore itself ago being found very rich and good. Falmouth is well built, has abundance of shipping belonging to it, is full of rich merchants, and has a flourishing and increasing trade. I say increasing, because by the late setting up the English packets between this port and Lisbon, there is a new commerce between Portugal and this town carried on to a very great value. It is true, part of this trade was founded in a clandestine commerce carried on by the said packets at Lisbon, where, being the king's ships, and claiming the privilege of not being searched or visited by the custom house officers, they found means to carry off great quantities of British manufactures, which they sold on board to the Portuguese merchants, and they conveyed them on shore, as it is supposed, without paying custom. But the government there getting intelligence of it, and complaint being made in England also, where it was found to be very prejudicial to the fair merchant, that trade has been effectually stopped. But the Falmouth merchants, having by this means gotten a taste of the Portuguese trade, have maintained it ever since in ships of their own. These packets bring over such vast quantities of gold in specie, either in moiters, which is the Portugal coin, or in bars of gold, that I am very credibly informed the carrier from Falmouth brought by land from thence to London at one time, in the month of January, 1722 or near it, 80,000 moiters in gold, which came from Lisbon in the packet boats for account of the merchants at London, and that it was attended with a guard of 12 horsemen well armed, for which the said carrier had 0.5% for his hazard. This is a specimen of the Portugal trade, and how considerable it is in itself, as well as how advantageous to England. But as that is not to the present case, I proceed. The custom house for all the towns in this port, and the head collector, is established at this town, where the duties, including the other ports, is very considerable. Here is also a very great fishing for pilchards, and the merchants for Falmouth have the chief stroke in that gainful trade. Truro is, however, a very considerable town too. It stands up the water north, and by east from Falmouth, in the utmost extended branch of the Avon, in the middle between the conflux of two rivers, which, though not of any long course, have a very good appearance for a port, and make it large wharf between them in the front of the town. And the water here makes a good port for small ships, though it be at the influx, but not for ships of burthen. This is the particular town, where the Lord Warden of the Stannaries always holds his famous Parliament of Miners, and for stamping of tin. The town is well built, but shows that it has been much fuller, both of houses and inhabitants, than it is now, nor will it probably ever rise, while the town of Falmouth stands where it does, and while the trade is settled in it as it is. There are at least 3 churches in it, but no dissenters' meeting house, that I could hear of. Tregony is upon the same water northeast from Falmouth, distance about 15 miles from it, but is a town of very little trade. Nor, indeed, have any of the towns, so far within the shore, notwithstanding the benefit of the water, any considerable trade, but what is carried on under the merchants of Falmouth or Truro. The chief thing that is to be said of this town is that it sends members to Parliament, as does also Grampound, a market town, and Borough, about 4 miles farther up the water. This place, indeed, has a claim to antiquity, and is an appendix to the Duchy of Cornwall, of which it holds at a fee farm rent and pays to the Prince of Wales as Duke £10.11 per annum. It has no parish church, but only a chapel of East to an adjacent parish. Penryn is up the same branch of the Avon as Falmouth, but stands 4 miles higher towards the west, yet ships come to it of as great a size as can come to Truro itself. It is a very pleasant, agreeable town, and for that reason has many merchants in it, who would perhaps otherwise live at Falmouth. The chief commerce of these towns, as to their sea affairs, is the pilchards and Newfoundland fishing, which is very profitable to them all. It had formerly a conventual church, with a chantry and a religious house, a cell to curtain, but they are all demolished, and scarce the ruins of them distinguishable enough to know one part from another. Quitting Falmouth Haven from Penryn West, we came to Helston, about 7 miles, and stands upon the little river Cober, which, however, admits the sea so into its bosom as to make a tolerable good harbor for ships a little below the town. It is the fifth town allowed for the coining tin, and several of the ships called tin ships are laden here. This town is large and populous, and has 4 spacious streets, a handsome church, and a good trade. This town also sends members to Parliament. Beyond this is a market town, though of no resort for trade, called Market Jew. It lies, indeed, on the seaside, but has no harbor or safe road for shipping. At Telford is a small but good harbor between Falmouth and this port, where many times the tin ships go in to load for London. Also here are a good number of fishing vessels for the pilchard trade, and abundance of skillful fishermen. It was from this town that in the great storm which happened November 27, 1703, a ship laden with tin was blown out to sea and driven to the Isle of Wight in 7 hours, having on board only 1 man and 2 boys. The story is as follows. The beginning of the storm there lay a ship laden with tin in Helford Haven, about 2 leagues and a half west of Falmouth. The tin was taken on board at a place called Gag Wharf, 5 or 6 miles up the river, and the vessel was come down to Helford in order to pursue her voyage to London. About 8 o'clock in the evening the commander, whose name was Anthony Jenkins, went on board with his mate to see that everything was safe, and to give orders, but went both on shore again, leaving only a man and 2 boys on board, not apprehending any danger, they being in safe harbor. However, he ordered them that, if it should blow hard, they should carry out the small bower anchor, and so to moor the ship by 2 anchors, and then giving what other orders he thought to be needful, he went ashore, as above. About 9 o'clock, the wind beginning to blow harder, they carried out the anchor, according to the master's order, but the wind increasing about 10, the ship began to drive, so they carried out their best bower, which, having a good new cable, brought the ship up. The storm still increasing, they let go the kedge anchor, so that they then rowed by 4 anchors ahead, which were all they had. But between 11 and 12 o'clock the wind came about west and by south, and blew in so violent and terrible a manner that, though they rowed under the lee of a high shore, yet the ship was driven from all her anchors, and about midnight, drove quite out of the harbor, the opening of the harbor lying due east and west, into the open sea, the men having neither anchor or cable or boat to help themselves. In this dreadful condition, they driving, I say, out of the harbor, their first and chief care was to go clear of the rocks which lie on either side the harbor's mouth, and which they performed pretty well. Then, seeing no remedy, they consulted what to do next. They could carry no sail at first, no, not a knot, nor do anything but run away afore it. The only thing they had to think on was to keep her out at sea as far as they could, for fear of a point of land called the Dead Man's Head, which lies to the eastward of Falmouth Haven, and then, if they could escape the land, thought to run in for Plymouth next morning, so, if possible, to save their lives. In this frighted condition they drove away at a prodigious rate, having sometimes the bonnet of their foresail a little out, but the yard lowered almost to the deck, sometimes the ship almost under water, and sometimes above, keeping still in the offing, for fear of the land, till they might see daylight. But when the day broke they found they were to think no more of Plymouth, for they were far enough beyond it, and the first land they made was Peveril Point, being the southernmost land of the Isle of Purbeck, in Dorsetshire, and a little to the westward of the Isle of Wight, so that now they were in a terrible consternation, and driving still at a prodigious rate. By 7 o'clock they found themselves broadside of the Isle of Wight. Here they consulted again, what to do to save their lives. One of the boys was for running her into the Downs, but the man objected that, having no anchor or cable nor boat to go on shore with, and the storm blowing offshore in the Downs, they should be inevitably blown off, and lost upon the unfortunate Goodwin, which, it seems, the man had been on once before and narrowly escaped. Now came the last consultation for their lives. The other of the boys said he had been in a certain creek in the Isle of Wight, where, between the rocks, he knew there was room to run the ship in, and at least to save their lives, and that he saw the place just that moment, so he desired the man to let him have the helm, and he would do his best and venture it. The man gave him the helm, and he stood directly in among the rocks, the people standing on the shore thinking they were mad, and that they would in a few minutes be dashed in a thousand pieces. But when they came nearer, and the people found they steered, as if they knew the place, they made signals to them to direct them as well as they could, and the young bold fellow run her into a small cove, where she stuck fast, as it were, between the rocks on both sides, there being but just room enough for the breadth of the ship. The ship indeed, giving two or three knocks, staved and sunk, but the man and the two youths jumped ashore and were safe, and the lading, being tin, was afterwards secured. N.B. The merchants very well rewarded the three sailors, especially the lad, that ran her into that place. Penzance is the farthest town of any note west, being 254 miles from London, and within about 10 miles of the promontory, called the Land's End, so that this promontory is from London 264 miles, or thereabouts. This town of Penzance is a place of good business, well built and populous, has a good trade, and a great many ships belonging to it, notwithstanding it is so remote. Here are also a great many good families of gentlemen, though in this utmost angle of the nation, and, which is yet more strange, the veins of lead, tin, and copper ore are said to be seen even to the utmost extent of land at low water mark, and in the very sea so rich, so valuable, a treasure is contained in these parts of Great Britain, though they are supposed to be so poor, because so very remote from London, which is the center of our wealth. Between this town and St. Burien, a town midway between it and the Land's End, stands a circle of great stones, not unlike those at Stonehenge, in Wiltshire, with one bigger than the rest in the middle. They stand about 12 feet asunder, but have no inscription. Neither does tradition offer to leave any part of their history upon record, as whether it was a trophy or a monument of burial, or an altar for worship, or what else, so that all that can be learned of them is that here they are. The parish where they stand is called Boscawen, from whence the ancient and honorable family of Boscawen derive their names. Near Penzance, but open to the sea, is that gulf they call Mount's Bay, named so from a high hill standing in the water, which they call St. Michael's Mount. The seamen call it only the Cornish Mount. It has been fortified, though the situation of it makes it so difficult of access that, like the base in Scotland, there needs no fortification. Like the base too, it was once made a prison for prisoners of state, but now it is wholly neglected. There is a very good road here for shipping, which makes the town of Penzance be a place of good resort. A little up in the county towards the northwest is Godolchin, which though a hill, rather than a town, gives name to the noble and ancient family of Godolphin, and nearer on the northern coast is Royalton, which since the late Sidney Godolphin Esquire, a younger brother of the family, was created Earl of Godolphin, gave title of Lord to his eldest son, who was called Lord Royalton during the life of his father. This place also is infinitely rich in tin mines. I am now at my journey's end. As to the islands of Scilly, which lie beyond the Land's End, I shall say something of them presently. I must now return Sir Mespas, as the French call it, though not literally so, for I shall not come back the same way I went. But as I have coasted the south shore to the Land's End, I shall come back by the north coast, and my observations in my return will furnish very well materials for another letter. Appendix to Land's End. I have ended this account at the utmost extent of the island of Great Britain West, without visiting those excrescences of the island, as I think I may call them, viz. The rocks of Scilly, of which what is most famous is their infamier approach. Namely, how many good ships are almost continually dashed in pieces there, and how many brave lives lost, in spite of the mariner's best skill, or the lighthouses and other sea marks' best notice. These islands lie so in the middle between the two vast openings of the North and South Narrow Seas, or, as the sailors call them, the Bristol Channel, and the channel so called by way of eminence, that it cannot, or perhaps never will, be avoided but that several ships in the dark of the night and in stress of weather, may, by being out in their reckonings, or other unavoidable accidents, mistake, and if they do, they are sure, as the sailors call it, to run bump ashore upon Scilly, where they find no quarter among the breakers, but are beat to pieces without any possibility of escape. One can hardly mention the bishop and his clerks, as they are called, or the rocks of Scilly, without letting fall a tear to the memory of Sir Cloudesley Shovel, and all the gallant spirits that were with him, at one blow, and without a moment's warning dashed into a state of immortality the admiral, with three men of war, and all their men running upon these rocks right afore the wind, and in a dark night, being lost there, and not a man saved. But all our annals and histories are full of this, so I need say no more. They tell us of 11 sail of merchant ships homeward bound, and richly laden from the southward, who had the like fate in the same place a great many years ago, and that some of them coming from Spain, and having a great quantity of bullion, or pieces of eight on board, the money frequently drives on shore still, and that in good quantities, especially after stormy weather. This may be the reason why, as we observed during our short stay here, several mornings after it had blown something hard in the night, the sands were covered with country people running to and fro to see if the sea had cast up anything of value. This the seamen call going ashoring, and it seems they do often find good purchase. Sometimes also dead bodies are cast up here, the consequence of shipwrecks among those fatal rocks and islands, as also broken pieces of ships, casks, chests, and almost everything that will float or roll on shore by the surges of the sea. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.